The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
There's two banks in Dodge City. Both are full of cattlemen's money, according to what I've heard. We hit them both hard and fast right after they open. Make examples out of them that tries to fight back. Gun them down like ducks coming off a pond.
I hear Dodge can be a tough town, Bill. Maybe you hadn't ought to figure that'll be that easy.
You done turned yellow dog on us, Curly. I got no use for a damn coward.
You ain't gonna shoot me, Bill.
You ain't left me no choice, Curly. I gotta make an example out of you.
We've been together since...
Any more you sons of bitches got anything to say?
My name's Wyatt Earp. I'm the city marshal. Just curious as to why you're carrying so many guns at this hour.
Smoke Jensen. I was headed down to check on a herd I brought in yesterday. As to the guns, I rarely go anywhere without them. Old habit, I reckon.
It's called fate. Some men have got the fates dead set against. Smoke is one. Most other men can ride all the way from California to Dodge City without having so much as a loose horseshoe. Smoke don't hardly ever get that kind of peace. It's the hand of fate that keeps guiding them toward the fight.
Welcome to Dodge, Mr. Bloody Bill Anderson. We've got a little surprise waiting for you.
Saddle up and ride into adventure with Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man 22. Pride of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
And now for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by James Konacek, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, Yasmin Toison, Thomas Penny, Scott McCormick, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Paul Fidalgo, Mort Shelby, Johann Detweiler, Stephen Carpenter, Daniel Gavigan, Tim Carlin, Joseph Thornhill, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Andy Clements, Terrence Aselford, and Ren Casey. The Last Gunfighter, number 20, Sudden Fury.
Whoa.
The sound of death came to Frank Morgan's ears through the forest. Towering, thick-trunked redwoods surrounded him. Frank heard the sounds clearly enough to know that they were close by. He reached for the butt of the Winchester that jutted up from a sheath strapped to Stormy's saddle. The rangy gray horse stood calmly as Frank pulled the rifle from the saddle boot. Stormy had been one of Frank Morgan's trail partners for a long time now, along with the big wolf-like cur known appropriately enough as Wolf. The horse was used to the sound of gunfire. He would have to be, considering that Frank Morgan was the notorious gunfighter known as the Drifter. Frank Morgan was middle-aged, a powerfully built man of medium height. The crisp dark hair under his high-crowned hat was shot through with silver threads. His face was too rugged to be called handsome, but it was the sort of face a lot of women looked at twice. He wore a butternut shirt, faded denim trousers, and boots aged to a comfortable fit. A Colt 45 Peacemaker rode in a plain brown holster on his right hip. A bowie knife with a staghorn handle rested in a fringed sheath on his left hip. The fringe was the only thing about Frank Morgan that could be considered even remotely gaudy. He was a simple man with relatively simple needs, the most overwhelming of which was to stay alive, because there were plenty of people west of the Mississippi who wanted the man called the Drifter dead. Born and raised in Texas, Frank had returned to the Lone Star State after the Civil War as a young cowboy, figuring he would spend the rest of his life working on a ranch, only to discover that he possessed a natural talent for drawing a gun and firing it accurately faster than most men could blink. Even though he'd never intended to become a gunfighter, once his boots were set on that path, there was no getting off it. Lord knows he had tried from time to time. But there were simply too many men, young and old, who wanted to match their speed and prowess with a gun against his. He had been forced to defend himself, and with each would-be conqueror who fell before his gun, the legend of the Drifter grew. He had married, tried to settle down. It hadn't worked. Violence had always reared its ugly head, often with tragic results. Now, 30 years after that young cowboy had returned to Texas from the war, he was alone, and he had vowed to himself that he would stay that way. From here on out, the Drifter would just drift. Frank had drifted here to the Redwood Country of Northern California from Los Angeles. A dust-up down in those parts had left him hankering for some peace and quiet, so he had meandered northward along the coastline. But he wasn't the sort of man who could turn his back on trouble and just ride away. Never had been, never would be. Judging by the violent sounds he heard, he was going to be delayed at least a little while. Frank sent Stormy trotting forward. Goldie, Frank's other horse, followed along behind, while Wolf loped ahead, nose to the ground. Frank couldn't ride too fast. He had to weave around the redwoods, most of which were at least 15 feet wide at the base. Some of the giant trees were as much as 25 feet wide, or even larger in isolated cases. They were certainly the biggest trees Frank had ever seen in all his long years of wandering.
Ease up, Stormy.
If whoever caused that ruckus was still up there ahead of him, there was no point in allowing galloping hoofbeats to announce his arrival. He smelled smoke, and then something else. Coffee, he realized after a second. Crews of loggers worked in this forest, felling and trimming the massive trees so they could be hauled off to mills where they would be sawed into millions of board feet of lumber. That lumber was destined for the homes and businesses of the civilization that had spread pretty much from one end of the continent to the other, leaving only pockets of wilderness untouched.
Maybe we're coming up on a logging camp.
Wolf had gotten so far ahead by now that the big cur had vanished. Frank wasn't worried too much. Wolf could take care of himself. But whatever had prompted those men to scream like that had to be pretty bad. Maybe he was a little worried after all.
Come on!
A few minutes later, they broke into a clearing. Huge stumps here and there told him where trees had been felled. Several large tents were set up around the clearing. Someone had dug a large fire pit in the center and ringed it with stones. A small fire crackled in the pit. A coffee pot perched on a metal grate above the flames. To one side sat a large frying pan with some bacon and biscuits in it. The men who'd made this camp had been preparing a midday meal. They'd never have to worry about that again. They were all dead. Their bodies scattered around the clearing. Frank's jaw tightened as he reined Stormy to a halt. His mouth was a grim line. He looked around the gore-splattered clearing and tried to figure out how many men had died here. He put the number at 6, although it was hard to be sure because they appeared to have been torn limb from limb. Frank had seen plenty of violent death in his life, but he wasn't sure he had ever come across anything like this before. He had heard stories about how grizzly bears could maul men until they barely looked human. As he gazed in horror around the clearing, his first thought was that a bear must have done this. But it would take a grizzly to wreak such destruction, and he didn't think they lived in this part of the country. There were black bears in California, but he doubted if one of those smaller bears could have killed 6 men. A black bear might have mauled 1 or 2 men, but those gunshots Frank had heard would have brought it down. The big cur nosed around the torn-up bodies.
Wolf, come away from there.
Still holding the Winchester, Frank swung down from the saddle and studied Stormy and Goldie. The horses were a mite skittish, but that was probably from the coppery smell of freshly spilled blood that filled the air.
They'd be spooked even more if they were picking up bear scent. And Wolf would be growling.
Wolf was curious about what had happened here, But the thick ruff of fur around his neck wasn't standing up as it would have been if he'd smelled a bear or some other immediate danger. Because of that, Frank knew that whatever had done this was gone. He walked over to take a closer look at the bodies. The men were still clad in blood-soaked clothing. Frank studied the boots that had metal caulks on their soles, the thick canvas trousers, and the woolen shirts, and he knew he was looking at loggers. The saws and axes and other gear scattered around the camp testified to that fact as well. He saw several pistols and a couple of rifles lying on the ground where the men had dropped them. The guns hadn't saved them. Somebody was coming. Frank swung around in time to see four men burst out of the woods, each of them carrying a long-handled, double-bitted axe. They stopped short and stared in shock at the horrible scene laid out before them. They were dressed the same as the dead men, with the addition of caps or narrow-brimmed hats. A couple wore holstered guns strapped high on their waists. After a moment, all four men slowly came forward into the clearing, gazing around at the corpses as if they couldn't believe what they were seeing. A broad-shouldered man with a bushy mustache that drooped over his mouth looked at Frank.
Mister, did you do this?
You really think one man could do this? I heard the shots and the screams and rode up to see what was going on. I imagine the same thing brought you fellas here. Did you know these men?
Yeah, we knew them. We were all part of the same crew.
And I'm sorry you lost your friends. You have any idea what might have happened?
The terror.
Yeah, the terror of the Redwoods.
What's that, some kind of animal?
It's not an animal, mister. It's a monster.
Just then, three men rode into the clearing. These newcomers were dressed very differently from the loggers. They wore range clothes and broad-brimmed Stetsons. They had gun belts strapped around their hips and thonged to their thighs, and they carried Winchesters as well. Frank recognized the sort of men they were. Gun throwers, hard cases, hombres much like himself. He faced the riders who had just entered the clearing. One of them gestured toward the bloody corpses.
By jingo! The terror did this, didn't it?
That's right, mister. You fellas are hunting a damn thing, aren't you?
Damned right we are. We're gonna collect that bounty.
Who's put out a bounty?
Haven't you heard about it, mister?
I just rode into these parts today.
Well, the terror's been around here for months now, scaring folks. When it started killing people, though, Mr. Chamberlain put out the word to be a big reward for whoever kills it.
Who's Chamberlain?
Rutherford Chamberlain, the timber baron. He owns the lease on these woods for miles around. It's his men who've been killed. So he said that he'd pay $10,000 for the terror's head.
Frank knew now why he had recognized Chamberlain's name. He had seen it on various documents his lawyers had shown him one time when he visited their offices in San Francisco. No one would think it to look at him, but Frank Morgan was one of the richest men in the country. He had inherited half of the far-flung business empire founded by his late wife, Vivian Browning. The Browning holdings included some logging interests. Frank had never cared about business, and money mattered to him only as long as he had enough to keep him in supplies, so he trusted his attorneys to take care of everything for him. It was possible that he owned stock in Chamberlain's company. It was equally possible that he and Chamberlain were competitors. Frank didn't know and didn't care.
By jingo, I know who you are, fella. You're Frank Morgan.
And you're Jingo Reed.
You heard of me, have you?
Wait a minute. You mean that's the hombre they call the Drifter?
He sure is. I saw you gun down the McClatchy brothers in Flagstaff a few years ago, Morgan. You were mighty fast. But I reckon I'm faster.
Hey, Jingo, we need to get on the trail of that monster. I want to get that 10 grand reward.
I do too, but the varmint will wait. I got something just as big right here.
Don't do it, Jingo. I'm not looking for any trouble with you.
That's the way life is, Morgan. Trouble comes at you whether you're looking for it or not.
And with that, Reed clawed at the gun on his hip, his hand moving with blinding speed. Frank's Colt appeared in his hand as if by magic. Jingo had barely cleared leather before Frank's bullet smacked into his chest. Spooked by the shot, Reed's horse bucked and threw him off. He crashed down on the ground and lay in a limp sprawl, not moving.
Damn it! He done killed Jingo!
The man swung the barrel of his rifle toward Frank. With more time now, Frank didn't have to shoot to kill again. He broke the man's shoulder with a bullet instead. The man dropped his rifle and clutched at his wounded shoulder. Frank shifted his aim toward the third hard case, who quickly held up both hands in plain sight.
Don't shoot now, Morgan. I don't want any part of this.
That's a smart move. You boys should have gone after the terror while you had the chance. Now you got to tend to your friend and take Jingo to the undertaker.
All right to put my hands down?
Just keep them away from your guns.
The man dismounted and began helping his wounded companion climb out of the saddle.
I never saw a draw that slick in all my life. Is it true, mister? Are you really Frank Morgan?
That's my name.
No offense, Mr. Morgan, but I figured you were dead by now. I've been hearing stories about you since I was a kid. I even read some of the dime novels about you.
Stories get exaggerated. And you got to remember, dime novels are written by fellas who don't really know what they're talking about even when they're sober, which they usually aren't.
Yeah, but you're still the drifter.
Reckon a couple of you boys could put Jingo on his horse?
Two of the loggers picked up the gunman's corpse and draped it over the saddle. Reed's horse didn't care for having a dead body on its back, so another logger held the reins while the first two lashed the corpse into place. By now, the uninjured man had used his bandana to tie up the wounded shoulder of his friend. The loggers had to help him get back on his horse. The third hard case mounted up again.
Now, no hard feelings, Morgan. Sure as hell wasn't my idea for Jingo to slap leather like that. He's always wanted to make a big name for himself as a gunman, and I reckon he figured killing you was the best way.
No hard feelings, as long as you really let it go and don't try to bushwhack me later. I wouldn't take kindly to that.
Don't worry. I'm not that stupid. Anyway, I still want that 10 grand reward for the terror. I'm gonna be kind of busy hunting that monster. I don't have time to get myself killed throwing down on the drifter.
Leading the other two horses, the man turned his mount and hitched it into motion. He rode off into the trees and was soon out of sight among the thick, towering trunks. The leader of the loggers stuck out his hand to Frank.
My name's Carl Wilcox. It's an honor to meet you, Mr. Morgan. I just wish it was under better circumstances.
So do I.
This is Dave Neville, Asa Peterson, and Gus Trotter.
I imagine you fellas would like to gather up your friends' bodies. I'll give you a hand.
Yeah, we've got a wagon back yonder in the woods. Gus, go get it. The rest of us will start rolling up the bodies in blankets.
That was a particularly grim, grisly chore, since some of the bodies were in pieces. The loggers were able to tell which pieces went together, or at least they claimed they could. Frank certainly wasn't going to argue with them. He hadn't known any of the dead men. Gus Trotter came back with the wagon. Two mules were hitched to the vehicle, and numerous logging tools were heaped in the back of it. The loggers shoved those tools aside to make room for the corpses.
What's the nearest town?
That'd be Eureka. That's where we'll take these poor fellas.
I reckon that's where I'll find Rutherford Chamberlain, too.
Nope. Mr. Chamberlain doesn't go into town much. He conducts all his business from his house.
Where's that?
About 5 miles north of here. Can't miss it. Biggest damn house I ever saw. And nearly all of it is made out of redwood.
He lives in the forest?
That's right. He always says that since the woods made him his fortune, that's where he's gonna live. You plan to go see him, Mr. Morgan?
I might.
Be careful when you ride up. He's always got men on guard, and with everything that's going on in these parts, they're probably pretty nervous. They might get trigger-happy.
Much obliged for the warning. I'll keep it in mind.
The loggers made ready to leave for Eureka with their gruesome cargo.
You know, Mr. Morgan, when we first got here, I thought for a second you had done that to our friends. Or rather, that dog of yours. I figured it was a wolf when I first saw it.
I'm glad you stopped to find out what was really going on before jumping to conclusions.
So are we. If we'd gone after you or the dog, I reckon you'd have shot all four of us. You gonna look for the terror?
I'm not in the business of hunting monsters.
Huh.
The wagon rolled off toward Eureka, loaded down with 6 corpses and 4 live, scared men. Dave Neville handled the reins. Wilcox, Peterson, and Trotter gripped their axes tightly and swiveled their heads from side to side, constantly on the lookout for danger. Before mounting up, Frank walked all the way around the clearing, studying the ground. A thick carpet of redwood needles covered it, built up from centuries of shedding by the huge trees. There were also a lot of brittle cones lying around. Frank had hoped that whatever killed those loggers might have left some tracks, but that wasn't the case. He didn't see any prints among the needles. That left Wolf's nose.
How about it, fella? You smell anything unusual?
Wolf trotted around the clearing. He paused in one spot, lifting his head and peering off into the woods.
What is it, Wolf? You smell some sort of critter?
Frank studied the ground at this spot. Something might have kicked through the needles, but he couldn't be sure about that. The horses came over to him, and he swung up on Storm.
Wolf, trail.
Wolf took off through the woods, nose close to the ground. Frank followed, riding Stormy and leading Goldie. Wolf didn't move so fast that he got out of Frank's sight. He weaved through the trees, heading first one direction, then another, as if whoever or whatever he was tracking didn't have any specific destination in mind, but was just roaming aimlessly through the forest. That sounded like the behavior of an animal.
Maybe a grizzly bear wandered over here into California from the Rockies.
It wasn't impossible. That didn't explain why Wolf hadn't growled when he picked up the scent, but there might be some reason for that. Or maybe the predator was some sort of freakishly large wolf. Wolf paused suddenly and lifted his head. Frank twisted in the saddle to gaze off to his right into the perpetual twilight under the giant trees, but didn't see anything moving. Wolf whirled to the left. Were there two of them, whatever they were? That would help explain how six men had died back there. Frank felt his heart hammering in his chest. He wasn't afraid. He had never run into anything that a well-placed bullet couldn't take down, and he didn't believe he was going to here. But there was something about the gloom and the trees towering over him like giants, and the memory of blood and scattered body parts. Frank felt somewhat relieved. Riders in the woods were one thing. Some bizarre, mysterious something that could rip six men from limb to limb was another thing entirely. But men could be mighty dangerous too, he reminded himself. He had seen ample evidence of that in his life. And as if to emphasize that, a bullet fired from Frank's right whizzed through the trees, much too close for comfort. More shots came from the left in return, and in the blink of an eye, slugs were sizzling through the brush and smacking into tree trunks all around Frank.
Son of a...
He threw himself off Stormy, grabbed the reins of both horses, and led them hurriedly toward a deadfall he had spotted up ahead. Rather than being felled by loggers, the massive redwood had toppled over due to some natural cause, probably years earlier. These trees took a long time to rot, though, so the log was still in fairly good shape. It stood 15 feet tall, too, so it would offer some protection if Frank and the horses could get behind it.
Wolf, stay down!
They reached the deadfall. That shielded them from the shots coming from one direction, anyway.
Over here! I got it!
Frank understood now what was going on. Two separate groups of hunters looking for the terror of the redwoods and that $10,000 bounty had mistaken each other for their quarry and opened fire.
Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
Hey! Who's that?
Hold your fire! You're just shooting at each other!
Don't shoot anymore!
Three riders came into view, carrying their rifles at the ready. Frank stepped out from behind the huge log and raised a hand.
Was that you we were shooting at, mister?
Yeah, but you're also shooting at another bunch over there.
Frank wheeled in that direction. He had heard shrieks like that not long before, and six men had died. He jerked his Winchester from the saddle boot and broke into a run toward the sounds. As thick as the woods were, he could move just as fast on foot as the other men could on horseback. He charged through the trees for several moments. Then had to leap aside as a runaway horse suddenly loomed up right in front of him. The animal's eyes were wide and rolling with fright. Foam drooled from its mouth. It wasn't paying any attention to where it was going. Another shape appeared in the shadows before him, coming toward him at a fast rate of speed. Frank stopped and swung the rifle up, ready to fire if whatever it was attacked him. It wasn't a monster, though, or even some sort of wild animal. It was a man, running for his life like Satan himself was after him. A crimson smear of blood covered his face, and he kept looking behind him as he plunged heedlessly through the forest.
Hey, stop! You're all right!
The man never slowed down. Frank stepped to the side so that the hombre wouldn't barrel right into him, leaned the rifle against a tree trunk, and reached out to grab the man as he went by.
No, let me go,
Calm down! Calm down!
Frank wrapped his arms around him, the muscles in his arms and shoulders bunching under the butternut shirt as he jerked the fleeing man to a halt. The fellow wasn't going to settle down without a fight, though. He was too hysterical from fear to do that. Frank grabbed hold of the front of the man's shirt, shoved him back a step, and drove a short but powerful punch to the hombre's jaw. Frank let go of him and crumpled to the needle-covered ground at Frank's feet. The riders had arrived while Frank was struggling with the stranger. They looked down at the stunned man.
Who's that?
I think his name's Scott. I've seen him in Eureka.
Man, looks like something tore into him.
That was true. Most of the blood on the man's face came from a hideous gash that slanted across his forehead, but he had some smaller cuts and scratches on his cheeks, too. His shirt was torn and bloodstained, like something had tried to claw it off him. Frank realized that the screaming had stopped. He picked up his rifle and looked up at the men on horseback.
Couple of you come with me. The other one stay here and keep an eye on this gent.
Who are you to be giving orders, mister?
The man who's giving the orders. Come on.
Well, I'll stay here with Scott. Just don't you fellas be gone too long. The critter's still roaming around here in these woods. Unless I've missed my guess.
Frank led the way, stalking forward with the Winchester at the ready. In a few minutes, he spotted what looked like two heaps of old clothing lying on the ground ahead of him. He had a bad feeling that there was more to the heaps than old clothes, though. Unfortunately, he was right. He saw the torn and mangled bodies as he came closer. Blood formed reddish-black pools around both dead men. Not only had their flesh been shredded, but their throats were torn out as well. These injuries looked more like something an animal would inflict. The killer hadn't taken the time to rip the bodies apart this time.
Holy mother God!
It was a terror! That's what it was! No doubt about it! The damn thing's gone on a real rampage this time!
There's nothing we can do for these fellas. Let's go back and see about that other one.
They returned to the spot where they had left Scott and the third rider. The injured man had regained his senses, at least to a certain extent. He sat with his back against the trunk of a redwood. He had his knees drawn up and his arms wrapped around them. He swayed back and forth.
I was gonna try to clean up these wounds a little, but he won't let me touch him. Figured if I tried too hard, I might spook him, make him run off again.
It was good thinking to leave him alone. I'll see what I can get out of him.
Frank went over to the man and hunkered on his heels, not getting too close to him. The man rolled his eyes in Frank's direction and cringed away.
It's all right. That thing that killed your friends and hurt you is gone. You're safe now.
No, nobody's safe. Nobody's safe in the woods. The terror's out there.
Did you see it?
It came out from behind a tree. Knocked Billy off his horse. I never saw anything move so fast.
What did it look like?
Big, hairy. Must have been 9 feet tall, and it had these claws. It tore out Billy's throat with one swipe. There was blood all over him. We tried to shoot him, but it was too fast. It went for Rance. Rance's horse spooked through him. So did mine. The thing, it jumped on Rance. He was tearing him up, slashing at him with those claws. He was trying to dig his insides out. Then it came for me. Hit me once and knocked me clear across the open space between two trees.
How did you manage to get away?
Is it just luck? The thing started tearing at me like it had done to Rance. And then one of the horses stampeded right into it, knocked it off of me. I got up and ran. It could have come after me. Could have caught me. I don't know why it didn't. Maybe the horse hurt him. Maybe it was just tired of playing with us.
You hear that, boys? The thing's hurt. We can track it down for sure now.
You don't know that. Like this hombre said, maybe it had some other reason for leaving. You must have gotten a good look at it. Could it have been a bear? Maybe a grizzly that wandered over here from somewhere in the Rockies.
It wasn't a bear. It was hairy all over like a bear, but it wasn't a bear.
How can you be sure of that?
It didn't have a snout like a bear. And it went on two legs.
Bears can get around on two legs.
Not like this.
Some other sort of animal then?
No, it was more like a man's face, but bigger, hairier. It was the ugliest thing I ever seen.
Sounds like one of those Sasquatch critters they got up north.
Yeah, I heard them called Bigfoot, too. They're supposed to be 9 feet tall and hairy, just like this hombre said.
This fella needs medical attention. I want the three of you to take him to Eureka.
Hell no! There's $10,000 on a hoof not far from here. We're gonna go find it.
You can't. It'll kill you two just like it did Billy and Rance.
We can handle some damn old Bigfoot.
You don't know. It's worse than that. I can't even tell you how bad it really is. Like it's not even from this world.
You saw what it did to those two men. Well, just a little while ago, it killed 6 more the same way, only worse. Those hombres, it tore apart. Flat out tore them apart.
Maybe it would be better to come back later. Maybe get some more men first.
That'd mean splitting the bounty more ways.
I'd rather have a little less to spend than still be alive to spend it.
Well, I'm not going.
Yes, you are.
Who the hell are you to be telling me what to do? Now, folks say I'm pretty fast on the draw, and if you ain't careful, I might just show you.
That wouldn't be a very good idea. My name's Frank Morgan.
Morgan? The gunfighter?
One and the same.
You'd best back off, Tom. Being fast for around here don't mean nothing against a man like Frank Morgan.
Yeah, all right. We'll do like you say, Morgan. We'll take this fella in and find a Sawbones to patch him up. I didn't mean any offense.
None taken.
Well, what are you going to do if you don't mind my asking?
Are you going after the monster? Oh, that'd be something. The Drifter taking on the Terror.
I thought I'd pay a visit to that fella Chamberlain. I don't believe it's a good idea to be throwing out a bounty like that. It can lead to more trouble than it's worth.
It won't do you any good. From what I hear, Chamberlain's a big skookum he-wolf in these parts. He's used to doing as he pleases.
Well, maybe I can talk some sense into his head. If I can figure out which way's north, it's hard to tell in this blasted forest where you can't hardly see the sky.
Frank had a keen sense of direction, though, so it only took him a few minutes to orient himself once he had picked up his horses and wolf. As he rode off, he could hear the other riders moving through the trees toward the settlement of Eureka to the east. Scott was riding double with one of them. Frank kept his eyes and ears open. From the way Scott had talked, whatever had attacked them had struck with no warning, moving so fast that they couldn't even hit it with their shots. Frank didn't know if he would fare any better should the thing jump him, but he didn't intend to go down without a fight, even if he was facing some 9-foot-tall hairy critter with giant claws. Nothing bothered him, though, and after a while he came to a fairly wide, hard-packed dirt road that led more directly northward. Frank had a hunch it led to Rutherford Chamberlain's house. He wondered how much it had cost to hack a good road like this out of the thickly timbered wilderness. It must have been a pretty penny, but he supposed Chamberlain could afford it. A few minutes later, the road reached a huge clearing. The trees had been stripped from a small hill to form the estate, and at the top of the gentle slope stood a mansion, the likes of which Frank hadn't ever seen anywhere except San Francisco, Denver, and Boston. As a matter of fact, he wasn't sure he had ever seen anything like it in those places. He recognized the sort of men who came galloping around the house and charging toward it, though. They bristled with guns, and they were looking for trouble. Frank saw several rifles and shotguns among the men. He reined Stormy to a halt.
Wolf, sit. Stay.
He didn't want the big cur to give the men any excuse for being trigger-happy. For that same reason, he kept his hands in plain sight, well away from his guns. These men were Rutherford Chamberlain's bodyguards, he told himself, and they were just doing their job as they surrounded him.
Take it easy, gents. I'm plumb peaceable.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
I'm looking for a Mr. Chamberlain. I just want to talk to him.
The spokesman, who had an ugly raw-boned face and straw-colored hair under a black Stetson, sneered at Frank.
Well, he don't want to talk to you.
Maybe you should ask him about that.
Yeah, maybe you should just go to hell.
I still haven't told you who I am.
I've decided it don't matter. I can tell by looking at you that you're just some old saddle tramp. And Mr. Chamberlain ain't got time for trash like you. Vamoose!
Frank knew that he ought to just tell this man who he was. Most likely, the name Frank Morgan would open the door of the mansion. But he was just stubborn enough not to do that. This hombre's arrogance had gotten under his skin, and he knew it would be like a burr under a saddle if he didn't do something about it. He pressed his heels against Stormy's flanks. The horse moved forward. The leader of the guards jumped his mount ahead to block Frank's path.
Are you loco, mister? You get out of here right now or you're gonna be sorry.
I'm gonna talk to Chamberlain and you're not gonna stop me.
There are 8 of us.
No, I said you're not gonna stop me.
Why, you son of a bitch. You think I'm scared of you?
Cobb, maybe you better be careful. I don't like the looks of this hombre.
I don't either. That's why I intend to change him a mite. Get down off your horse, mister.
Before I do, I want your word that this is between you and me. And I don't want any of your men bothering my dog or my horses either. If they try, they'll be sorry.
Yeah, whatever you say, mister.
I have your word?
Hell yeah. You fellas stay out of it here.
Yeah, I'll be glad to.
Cobb swung down from his saddle, unbuckled his gun belt, and hung it on the saddle horn. He put his hat on top of it. He was a couple of inches taller than Frank, but probably packed about the same amount of weight on his rangy frame. He wore a white shirt, a black vest, and black leather wrist cuffs. Frank dismounted as well and removed his gun and hat. Cobb gestured at the bowie knife on Frank's left hip.
Get rid of that pig sticker, too.
Frank slid the fringed sheath off his belt and tucked it and the knife in his saddlebags.
Just so we're clear, once I've gotten past you, your friends won't stop me from going on up to the house, right?
You won't get past me.
But if I do?
Yeah. Let him talk to the boss, boys. If the boss is willing to see him, I can't promise any more than that.
Fair enough.
Frank hadn't gotten the words completely out of his mouth before Cobb charged him. The man was fast, but Frank was able to twist out of his way. As Cobb stumbled past, Frank hit him on the ear. Cobb swung around with a look of rage on his face. He threw a looping punch at Frank's head. Frank blocked it, stepped in, and landed a hard right on Cobb's sternum. The blow rocked Cobb back a step and set him up for the left hook that Frank exploded on his jaw. Cobb went down on one knee. Cobb came up from the ground and launched himself into a diving tackle with his arms spread wide. Frank couldn't avoid Cobb wrapping an arm around his thighs and driving him backward off his feet. When Frank hit the ground, the impact knocked the air out of his lungs. He rolled to the side to avoid Cobb's knee as Cobb tried to plant it in his groin. Frank brought his elbow back and shook his opponent on the jaw with it. He twisted around, got his left hand on Cobb's throat, and bounced the man's head off the ground. Cobb brought his left up, and his knobby fist crashed into the side of Frank's head and sent him sprawling. Cobb dove after Frank. He rolled onto his back and managed to get his right leg up in time to drive the heel of his boot into Cobb's belly. Frank reached up, grabbed Cobb's vest, and clawed hard on it, at the same time as he levered the man into the air on his leg. Cobb sailed through the air over Frank's head and crashed onto the ground. Frank flipped over, landed on Cobb, and slugged him on the jaw again. Pinning his opponent to the ground with a knee in his belly, Frank hit Cobb twice more, a left and a pile driver right. Cobb's head lolled loosely on his neck as he lay there on his back with his arms and legs straddled out.
If you're thinking about hitting him again, Morgan, I wouldn't. He's out.
You recognize me.
That's right. Cobb's damn lucky he just tried to thrash you. If he'd thrown down on you, you probably would have killed him. Better a beating than a bullet in the heart.
Rockwell, who the hell is this Jasper? You act like you know him.
No, we never met, but he was pointed out to me one night in a saloon in Fort Worth. His name's Frank Morgan.
Morgan? You mean the gunfighter?
One and the same.
Whew, you're right. Cobb's lucky to be alive.
Frank went over to Stormy and got his hat from the saddle. He put it on and then buckled the gun belt around his hips. A couple of the guards had dismounted. They reached down, took hold of Cobb's arms, and lifted him to his feet. He sagged in their grip and would have fallen if they hadn't been supporting him, but he was starting to come around now. He gave a groggy shake of his head.
Come on, I'll take you up to the house. I think you knocked all the fight out of Cobb, but it'll be simpler if you're already inside when he wakes up good.
Frank nodded. He picked up the horse's reins and motioned for Wolf to follow him. Rockwell led the way along a path made of crushed rock that ran through a green lawn in front of the house. It widened out into an area where buggies could be parked. From there, the path ran on around the mansion toward a carriage house and several other outbuildings. The house itself was one of the oddest, yet most impressive structures Frank had ever seen. It was a three-story Victorian, topped by a square tower with a steep roof and a long metal spire that served as a lightning rod. There were more gables than Frank could count, each one topped by a lightning rod as well. And although he was no architect, they seemed to be placed rather haphazardly around the roof. A room jutted out from the front of the house, cutting off a porch that appeared to wrap the rest of the way around the house. The porch railings were wrought iron and decorated with elaborate curlicues and designs. Latticework framed the windows, and carvings were everywhere in the wood. Frank saw birds and animals, moons and stars, even human faces. The whole place had a reddish gleam in the sun, and he recalled that Carl Wilcox had said the mansion was made out of the redwood that had brought Rutherford Chamberlain his fortune. Frank thought that if he had to live in a place like this, he would go plumb loco in a week.
It's really something, isn't it?
It's something, all right. Just not sure what.
The old man designed it himself. He says the woods made him a rich man, so it's only fitting that he lives here among the trees.
I hear that he does all his business from here and doesn't go into town very often.
Hardly ever. He used to get out more, but Mrs. Chamberlain passed away a few years ago, and now Mr. Chamberlain just stays in the house unless there's some sort of emergency.
I guess he figures no one will bother him here. It must have really shaken him up when this whole business with the terror started.
Ah, the terror. I sort of figured you were here about that. Going after the money, are you?
I want to talk to Mr. Chamberlain about the bounty. What do you think about the terror? Ever seen it?
No, and I don't want to. Call me hard-headed, but I'm not sure the damn thing really exists. The evil that men do is bad enough, without there being monsters in the world.
Frank tied Stormy and Goldie to a fancy hitching post in front of the house.
Wolf, stay.
Then the two men walked up onto the porch. The front door was a massive slab of varnished redwood with a bronze lion's head knocker so big that for a second, Frank thought Chamberlain must have gotten it from a real lion.
They probably heard the commotion inside, so they'll know that something was going on.
As if to support his words, the door opened almost right away. A tall, cadaverous man with white hair and a white mustache stood there. He wore a black suit. Frank had seen enough butlers in his life to recognize the breed.
What is it, Rockwell? Who is this man?
He's here to see Mr. Chamberlain. His name is Frank Morgan.
What's the nature of your business? I'll have to explain to Mr. Chamberlain why you wish to see him.
It's about the bounty. The bounty on that thing the loggers call the Terror.
Have you come to collect? Do you have the creature's head with you?
No, and no. I don't much believe in bounties. And I sure don't believe in hacking off somebody's head just to collect one.
I don't understand. Why do you wish to see Mr. Chamberlain if you don't intend to collect the reward?
That's between him and me.
I fail to see why you brought this man to the house. I don't think he has any need to see Mr. Chamberlain.
I do. Like I told you, he's Frank Morgan.
Is that name supposed to mean something to me?
He's the Drifter, for God's sake. He's a gunfighter. Some say the last real gunfighter, since Moke Jensen and Matt Bodine hung up their guns and Wes Harden's dead. If he's got something to say, I reckon the boss would be well advised to listen.
Very well. Please come in, Mr. Morgan. I'll see if Mr. Chamberlain's willing to speak with you.
Much obliged, Mr...
Dennis, sir. Just Dennis. No Mr. required.
See you later, Morgan.
Thanks, Rockwell.
You can wait in the library.
The redwood floor in the foyer had been polished to a high sheen. The hallway down which the butler led Frank was the same way. Portraits of stern-looking men and impassive women hung on the walls. Dennis ushered Frank through a pair of double doors into a large, rather dark room. Bookshelves lined all four walls from floor to ceiling. The furnishings consisted of a writing desk and several comfortable-looking armchairs. Thick drapes hung over the room's single window. They were pulled back part of the way to let in some light.
I'll advise Mr. Chamberlain that you're here, sir.
No hurry.
Frank meant it. The sight of all those books intrigued him. Like a lot of men who spent most of their time alone, he was an avid reader and nearly always had a book or two, sometimes more, stuffed in his saddlebags. He wouldn't mind taking a look at the volumes Rutherford Chamberlain had collected. Dennis left the room, closing the doors behind him. Frank set his Stetson on one of the chairs and walked over to the nearest bookshelf. Most of the books were bound in expensive leather. He always read cheap editions, because they took quite a beating from being toted around in his saddlebags. He spotted a novel he had read before and enjoyed.
Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
This was a different edition, though, so he was about to take it down and flip through it when he heard the library doors open behind him. He turned, expecting to see either Rutherford Chamberlain or the butler Dennis explaining that Chamberlain had refused to see him. Instead, a blonde, very attractive young woman had stopped just inside the library, and she seemed to be as surprised to see Frank as he was to see her. The young woman wore a dark blue dress with long sleeves and a high neckline. Despite its demure cut, the dress was snug enough to reveal an excellent figure.
I'm sorry. I was looking for my father. Were you waiting to speak to him?
That's right, Miss Chamberlain. My name is Frank Morgan.
Father knows you're here?
I suppose he does. That fella, Dennis, went to tell him.
I see. Do you mind if I ask what your business is with my father?
Well, I want to speak to Mr. Chamberlain about the bounty he's placed on that thing they call the Terror.
Are you here to collect? Have you killed it?
No, ma'am, I haven't. I haven't even seen it. But I've seen its handiwork. It killed 8 men this afternoon.
No. That can't be true.
I'm afraid it is. I saw the bodies myself. They've been taken into Eureka.
Do you know who they were?
Six of them were loggers from a crew working about 5 miles south of here. The other two men were hunters who were after the bounty on the Terror. It got them instead of the other way around.
How terrible. Are you going after the Terror, Mr. Morgan?
I'm not a bounty hunter of men or monsters. What do you know about it? Have you seen it?
I have to go.
Before Frank could say anything else, she turned and disappeared through the double doors. A second later, someone else approached the library. Frank assumed this must be Rutherford Chamberlain. The young woman must have heard him coming. Frank thought that must be why she had rushed out of the library. For some reason, she didn't want her father to know that she had been in here talking to the visitor. The woman had left the doors open. A moment later, a man in a brown tweed suit appeared in them. He was about the same height as Frank, and his broad shoulders indicated that he had been a powerful man at one time. Age, and perhaps grief, had drained him of some of his vitality, though. Chamberlain's hair and mustache were iron gray. Deep-set eyes looked out from a face that tended toward gauntness. The collar of his shirt was a little too big for his turkey neck.
You're Morgan?
That's right.
I'm told that you're a gunfighter. What's your business with me, sir?
It's about the bounty on the Terror.
Well, you're free to go after it just like anyone else. You don't have to make any special arrangements in advance.
I don't want the bounty. I think you should call it off.
Call it off? Well, that creature has killed almost half a dozen men. If the bounty helps rid the forest of it, the money will be well worth it, sir.
It's killed more than a half dozen men now. 8 more died this afternoon.
8 men? But who? How?
Quickly, Frank explained about the deaths of the loggers and the 2 bounty hunters. As he spoke, the hollows in Rutherford Chamberlain's cheeks became even more pronounced.
Oh, dear Lord. Well, perhaps I should invoke the devil's name instead, since that creature must come from the foulest, deepest pit of hell.
I wouldn't know about that. All I know is that you're going to have more men dying in these woods if you leave that bounty in force. They'll be killing each other by accident, rather than running into the Terror. It almost happened this afternoon.
He told Chamberlain what had happened when the 2 groups of bounty hunters opened fire on each other. Chamberlain's impatience grew visibly as he listened.
It's not my fault if those men are careless. I failed to see where it's my responsibility.
Your bounty is the reason they're out there in the first place, running around the woods and shooting at everything that moves. You can put a stop to it by spreading the word that there's not going to be any bounty.
I won't do it. I want that thing dead, no matter what it takes.
What about when your own loggers start getting shot by men who are hunting the Terror? That won't be good for morale among your crews. They're liable to walk off the job.
Well, there are always more men looking for jobs. If anyone is afraid to work in the woods, let him quit. And I'll simply hire someone to replace him. Anyway, don't you think I've already had men quit because they're afraid of the Terror?
Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that the woods aren't going to be safe for anybody as long as a bunch of trigger-happy fools are roaming around with visions of $10,000 in their heads.
Now I see where this is going. You want me to rescind the bounty and then hire you to hunt down and kill the monster. And I suppose the fee you'll suggest will be the same amount as the bounty, only you won't have to deal with any competition.
You got it wrong, Chamberlain. I didn't come here to get the job for myself.
Why not? You're a gunfighter. You've admitted as much. That means you sell your skills as a killer to the highest bidder, doesn't it?
I'm not a hired gun. Never have been. Any time I fought, it was to save my life or the life of someone else, or because I believed in a cause.
If you kill the Terror, you'll be saving the lives of all the men who might die because of it in the future. Now that I think about it, this is an excellent idea. Set one cold-blooded killer to catch another. I like it.
I reckon we're done here.
Wait a moment, Mr. Morgan. I'll do what you want. I'll rescind the bounty on the Terror, but only if you agree to hunt down and kill the creature yourself.
Forget it.
Of course, since you've seen what the monster can do, I can understand if you're afraid to go after it by yourself.
I've had plenty of damn fools try to prod me into gunfights by calling me a coward. It didn't work then, and it's not going to work now. You can say whatever you want. I'm not taking the job.
Well, then I suppose we are done, just as you say. But you realize, of course, this means the $10,000 bounty is still in effect.
Folks do foolish things all the time. I can't talk sense into all of them.
Frank stalked out of the library and headed toward the front of the house. The butler, Dennis, wasn't around, but Frank didn't need any help finding his way out. Just before he reached the front door, though, a voice spoke from a door to the side of the foyer.
Mr. Morgan, please wait.
Frank stopped and frowned. He turned and saw Chamberlain's daughter standing there, just inside the open doorway, which led into what appeared to be a small sitting room.
I need to talk to you.
I don't want to be rude, Miss Chamberlain, but your father and I have finished our business.
I know. I hope you'll forgive me, but I was listening just outside the library door. I knew you were talking about the terror, and I wanted to hear what you said.
Your father's liable to try to have me thrown out if he realizes I'm still here. But, I reckon I can spare you a minute or two.
Thank you. Please, come in here where we won't be disturbed.
Nancy moved back. Frank stepped into the sitting room, which was furnished with a pair of armchairs and a small table with a lamp on it. The blonde eased the door closed, then turned to face Frank.
What can I do for you?
We haven't been formally introduced. My name is Nancy Chamberlain.
It's a pleasure to meet you, miss. Wished it'd been under better circumstances.
So do I. I heard my father offer you the job of tracking down and killing the terror.
Yes, ma'am. I turned him down, though.
He said he'd take back that damned bounty if you did.
That's right. I don't think the bounty's a good idea, but I still don't want the job.
I wish you'd take it. You look like the sort of man who can handle a difficult job.
You want me to find the terror and kill it?
No, Mr. Morgan. I want you to find the terror and bring him home.
Him?
That's right. You see, Mr. Morgan, the terror is my brother.
I'm afraid you're going to have to explain that, ma'am.
What people have started calling the terror? He's my brother, Benjamin. He's not a monster, not at all.
Miss Chamberlain, less than 2 hours ago, I talked to a man who had just seen the terror. He said the thing was 9 feet tall, covered with hair, and had claws so big and sharp that it could, well, tear men apart with them.
You know how people exaggerate when they're scared. Ben is big. Well over 6 feet, in fact. And I suppose since he's been living in the woods, his hair and beard have gotten a little long and shaggy. As for the claws, I just don't believe it.
I saw what they did with my own eyes. It was bad, ma'am. Mighty bad.
I don't care. Ben couldn't hurt anyone. He's too gentle. And if he did, it's not his fault. There's something wrong in his head.
Despite his age and experience and almost supernatural skill with a gun, Frank was like most men in one respect. He didn't have any idea what to do when confronted by a crying woman. So he just waited quietly instead.
You don't believe me, do you?
It's not that I don't believe you, ma'am, but like I told you, I saw those men who'd been killed. It's hard to believe that whatever did it could even be human.
He is, I tell you, and no matter how much I don't want to admit it, I know he probably did kill those men, but it's not his fault. He's not right in his thinking.
You mean he's a lunatic?
That's such an ugly word. It makes you think of people locked away in some horrible, squalid place where all they do is rave all day. Ben's not like that. He never was. He was always sweet and gentle and kind. He was almost like a little child. Please don't misunderstand, Mr. Morgan. Ben's not one of those people who can't learn. He doesn't have the mind of a child in the body of a grown man or anything like that. He's actually very bright. But He lives in a world of his own, I suppose you could say. It got worse after Mother passed away. Ben didn't want to be around other people, even me, and we had always been close. He just wanted to be alone. That's why he ran away.
So your brother left home and went off to live in the woods?
Yes. Like Thoreau. Although I don't suppose you know who that is.
Begging your pardon, ma'am, but I don't reckon anything like what's going on in these woods ever happened around Walden Pond.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No offense taken, ma'am. Tell me more about your brother.
Well, like I said, Ben lives in a world of his own. But it was always a peaceful place. He never hurt anyone, never got in any sort of trouble. I never even heard him raise his voice in anger. Except...
Except what?
When he and Father argued. They were just too different to ever get along very well. Father thought that someday Ben would take over the business.
A lot of fathers expect that out of their sons.
Ben had no interest whatever in the timber business. Or any other business. He never did. Father tried to force him to work in the company office in Eureka. It didn't go well. They argued again and again. Ben just wasn't the sort of son that Father could be proud of. Finally, after Mother passed on, Ben said that he wasn't going into the office anymore. Father insisted that he was. They wound up shouting at each other, and Father told him to get out. He said he wouldn't have a son who was so shiftless and lacking in ambition. He said that Ben was no longer his son.
That had to hurt.
Yes, of course it did. I tried to tell Ben that Father didn't mean it, but we both knew that he did. I told Ben he didn't have to leave, but he insisted. He said he didn't want to have anything to do with the world of men anymore. He was going to go off into the woods and live by himself, surrounded by nature.
Like Thoreau.
Yes, like Thoreau.
How long ago was this?
2 years.
But the terror's only been causing trouble for a few months. How do you know what's been happening has anything to do with your brother? Ben might not even be alive anymore.
He's alive? At least, he was just before all this started.
How do you know?
Because I saw him in the woods.
You go out in those woods by yourself?
You have to understand, Mr. Morgan. Ben and I grew up around these giant redwoods. They're not frightening to us. The forest has always been our home. You're not scared of the place you grew up, are you?
Oh, we don't have 200-foot-tall trees where I'm from that grow so thick you can hardly see the sun. Anyway, there are wild animals in the forest, bears and wolves and things like that.
We know how to avoid the dangers. I've never been afraid to go in the woods. I was out there that day when I ran into him. Right after he left, I used to meet him and try to talk some sense into him. But gradually I came to see that it wasn't going to do any good. I hadn't seen him for months before that day. I was surprised. He had stopped taking care of himself. When he first went out there, he built a cabin and lived in it. But he told me that day that he didn't go into the cabin anymore. He wouldn't say why, but I got the impression he thought it was a bad place for some reason. He had let his hair and his beard grow, and he would barely talk to me. He seemed frightened of everything. You see, Mr. Morgan, that's how I know he couldn't be guilty of the things everyone is saying he is. He's too scared to hurt anyone. But it wasn't long after that when some of the loggers started talking about seeing a monster in the woods. I know it must be Ben. Before that, he had always been careful to avoid people. Something must have happened to change him. Maybe whatever it was that made him afraid to go back to his cabin.
Maybe it changed him so that he's not as gentle and peaceful as you remember him.
No. I know my brother, Mr. Morgan. He's not capable of such violence.
If you're so sure your brother is what they're calling the Terror, why haven't you told your father about it?
I have. I told him about seeing Ben in the woods. He didn't believe me. You see, when Ben left, he didn't tell Father where he was going. Father thinks that Ben ran off to San Francisco or somewhere like that. He said that's probably where Ben is now, drinking and associating with loose women.
No offense, Miss Chamberlain, but your father strikes me as a stubborn man.
That's certainly true, Mr. Morgan. But I think you can match him, if you want to. Will you do it? Will you find Ben and bring him back here so I can keep him safe?
How do you know he won't just run off again?
I'll figure out something. I'll just have to find a way to make him listen to reason.
If it turns out he killed those men, he'll have to face justice for it.
I'll deal with that when the time comes, too. At least if he's here or even in jail, he won't be shot down like an animal.
All right, Miss Chamberlain. I'll do my best to find your brother and bring him back here to you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Morgan.
Don't have to thank me yet. I haven't done anything.
No, but if you tell my father that you'll take the job after all, he'll stop offering that bounty.
I'll have to tell him that I'm going to kill the Terror to get him to do that.
He doesn't have to know the truth, though. He'll see that I was right once you bring Ben back here.
I'll talk to your father and I won't mention anything you told me.
Thank you so much.
There's one more thing. If I locate your brother, he's not gonna know me. And he probably won't listen to me, even if I tell him that you sent me to find him. Is there anything he'd know, something I could tell him, or some object he might recognize, so he'd be more likely to believe me?
Nancy frowned in thought for a moment, then reached behind her neck. Frank realized after a second that she was unfastening the clasp of a necklace. She took it off, pulling a small locket out from under her dress. She pressed the necklace and locket into his palm. Frank tucked the chain and locket into his shirt pocket.
Ben gave me that. His picture is in it. If there's anything left of the person he used to be, he'll recognize it.
That sounds like just what I need.